Good morning, everybody. Round two. I want to welcome everybody. First of all, I want to give a special thank you to Rabbi Helfgott, to Rabbi Nadi. When he saw on an email, I think, or on the website, that we were planning our Tanakh program, which is really modeled after a program he originated in New York that he runs every year, now under the auspices. Right, that you, everything is copied. We have a Masorah, 4,000-year-old history, but he really runs a program under the auspices of YCT Yeshivat, Yeshivat Chov Vei Torah, where he is the head of Jewish thought, the Open Orthodox Yeshiva in New York, that he is one of the integral parts of the yeshiva. So they sponsor a Tanakh Yom Iyun every year at the end of June, mainly for educators. It's done like on a Monday and Tuesday in the daytime. So it's, you know, people who have nothing else to do in the middle of the day. The end of June, after the school year is over. So we really decided we'd try to bring the concept to Toronto. And when, you know, Natty saw it, he called me up that he's coming, he's speaking, and YCT is going to be a part of it, so I want to thank him. We go back a long time, really, on a personal level. He's a wonderful person to have as a friend, and really a tremendous scholar, and one of the, really, I think, the leading, you know, thinkers and doers in the modern Orthodox world. He, like I, as a graduate of Yeshiva University, Rav Nadi is very close to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He studied with many of the great people in Israel. Nechama Leibowitz was a close teacher of his, and I think that's where you develop some of your love towards in Tanakh. He has published in English and Hebrew. He has a book out on Shmuel out in the hall, and we saw on the book he wrote on the letters of the Rav that we saw at the Rav conference. We have a few extra, the fascinating book that he edited. He's written a sefer in memory of his father in Hebrew, Bivit in Chidushei Torah. He has a degree in education, on and on, really an outstanding, you know, leader and thinker of our community. And without further ado, it's a pleasure to have him here and to have him speak on the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu and Pshat and Drush. Thank you.
It's always wonderful to be here at Torah Motion. I feel a real soul connection to my dear friend, Rabbi Jay Kelman, who's doing unbelievable work, and Chazak Ve'ematz from afar. And, you know, as the Gemara says, you know, don't worry about everybody else. Sofa kavod lavo. In the end, you know, unfortunately, some people don't always appreciate all the wonderful things that are going on. And just do your thing. I wanted to learn with you this morning the narrative of Moshe Rabbeinu, the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu and the youth of Moshe Rabbeinu in Peshat and Drash, because they're so different. And to raise some questions and discussion that emerges from a kind of close reading of the texts that we have in front of us. But I want to first put it into context. I want to frame what we're doing by recognizing that the birth of Moshe is presented as a very seminal idea, a very, very important stage in Jewish history. And just to set the stage, I want to start with a very strange midrash, actually, which many people in this room know. Sometimes we know more midrashim than we know text, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective in life. I want to start with the seventh pasuk of Sefer Shmot. Uvnei Yisrael paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu bimod meod vatimalei haaretz otam. The Jewish people were extremely, extremely fertile. They were very successful. They didn't have to go to any clinics. They were lots of kids, okay? Like today, lots of kids. Six kids, seven kids, eight kids, nine kids. The Midrash says that it didn't take 20 years, but the Midrash says that each one of the women had six kids at once. Can you imagine that? Six kids at once. Hopefully you get a lot of free diapers from those companies, right? They always hear about the people who have three kids, you know, they don't get anything. The people who have six kids, you know, they get in one shot. Where did the Midrash see this? And in fact, there's a Midrash which is less well known, the second opinion in the Midrash, which says that not only had six kids, they had 12 kids in one shot. Where did the Midrash get such a fantastic notion that's what happened? So on one level, you'll say the Midrash is trying to explain the great move. How did in the course of, remember, the Midrashic reading is that they were only in Egypt for 210 years. not 400 years as it says in the Bible itself. And the Midrash is claiming that there was this unbelievable fertility to go from 70 souls to go to 2 million people that left Egypt. 600,000 men between the age of 20 to 60, probably about 2 million people. But in the text, where did the Midrash see this? And what does it say about their reading of the biblical text? So the answer is pretty straightforward. This is a classic Midrashic technique. Verse 7, Ubnei Israel paruva yishritzuva yirbuva etzmubim od mod. Remember, Midrashim do not like, or let's put it differently, the Midrashic antenna always go up when there's a lot of verbs in a row in a text. The best example is by Esav. Vayakam, vayochal, vayesh, vayivez Esav et habchora. The Midrash is always struck by verbs in a row. And it always wants to find some existential or exegetical meaning to that. And so the Midrash says, we should read this as a message. Bnei Yisrael paru, 1. Vayishritzu, 2. Vayirbu, 3. Vayatzmu, 4. Bimod is taken as a verb. Vatimale ha'aret, 6. 6 verbs. 6 kids. That's the exegetical hook. Go further. What's the plural in rabbinic thinking? What is the minimum plural of 2? I gave it away already. What's Lashon Rabbim is always? 2. So what's 2 times 6? 12. That's the Midrashic hook. Let's step back from the Midrash and ask, what is the pshat? What is the text here trying to drive at in presenting us with this phrase here? Uvnei Yisrael, this pasu. Uvnei Yisrael paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu bimod meod. And it's very striking, and I think the answer is pretty straightforward. Many people have noticed it. What does this verse remind you of? When you think language, what language does it echo in your mind? Uvneso paru vayishritzu vayirbu pru urvu umilu et haaretz. This is creation language. Uvneso paru vayishritzu vayirbu vatimale haaretz otam. This is creation language. Even the phrase vayishritzu, which we usually think has to do with creepy crawly things, if you look at the second creation, and I don't mean Adam 2 of the Rav, I don't mean Perek Bet of Sefer Bereishit, I mean the real Adam 2. The real Adam 2, the Ramban, Nachmanides, is the first one who came up with the phrase Adam 2. Not the Rav, I love the Rav, we all love the Rav, but the first one who made up the phrase Adam 2 is the Ramban. The Ramban, in one of his drashot, says that Noach was Adam Hasheni. Noach was the second Adam, because the world is recreated. Turn back to the book of Genesis, and in the book of Genesis, chapter 9, after the world is recreated, so the Bible has mamish the same language as creation, and the Bible says, in chapter 9, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blesses human beings, Pasuk Aleph, Vayivarech Elohim et Noach ve'et banav, Vayomer lehem pru urvu umilu et haaretz. So sounds very nice. But at the end, God says, Va'atem, verse 7, Pru urvu shirtzu va'aretz urvuba. So notice that the phrase sheretz doesn't only apply to creepy crawly things, it also applies to human beings. The human beings are also given a bracha of to be a sheretz. Doesn't sound so nice, but that's what the text says. Number 2. Number 3, the phrase vaya'atzmu also is creation language. When man is presented with the woman who's been taken from his limb, so what does man say? Hine etzem me'atzamai u'basar mi'psari. The phrase bim'od ma'od is also creation language. Tov ma'od, etc. And as we said, vatimalei ha'aretz otam. Pru urvu milu et ha'aretz. What the Bible here in these 7 phrases is, and 7 of course is a key number. Anybody who's ever read Kasuto and everything, we all in this class, I'm sure we all know that. So 7 is actually the 7th verse in Parshat Shmot. I'm sorry. It's actually the seventh verse in Parshat Shmot. Okay, thank you very much. So, what we have here is a very powerful statement at the very beginning of Sefer Shmot, that the creation of the Am, the microcosmos, the microcosm, is parallel to the macrocosm. The beginning of the book of Shmot begins with the creation of the Am. Hine Am Yatzam Mitzrayim. The Jewish people are coming into being. And there's a parallel, and you can take this in many ways. Is the Bible continuing its mission, its message, that the ultimate redemption of the world will come through a specific nation that will bring a certain message about God to the world? Is the Bible saying we are now going to focus our energies on this microcosm for the next, you know, thousands of years, which will make an impact on the whole world? Whatever way you take it, it's clear that there's echoes of creation here. And the same thing is true on a pshat level in the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, think about it. Just think thematically for a second. And many people have noticed this, as I said. And the Bible presents the creation of the microcosm, the Jewish people, a world unto itself, the beginning of Shemot, parallel to the beginning of Bereishit. And this world is threatened with extinction. The Jews are about to be, are thrown, the little Jewish baby boys are thrown into the sea. Reminds you of something else. Reminds you of creation where the world, because of its evil, is about to be destroyed because of water, the Mabul. And how is the world saved? The world is saved through one family that is in a teva, that's in an ark. The only two places in the Chumash where you have an ark and a description of how the ark is made, b'chomer, b'zefet, is in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and in Shmot, Perek Bet. The creation of the world is threatened with extinction. The creation of the microcosmos represented by Moshe Rabbeinu is threatened with extinction and is saved through an act of a teva, through the benef and the divine providence that is connected with the teva. Very powerful stuff. And in fact, when we turn to chapter 2, the birth of Moshe, there's also creation language. Vatahar ha'isha vateled bein, vatere oto kitovhu. And she saw that he was goodly. What do you mean goodly? Doesn't every mommy love their child? Even though, you know, little babies when they come out, they look like lizards, but they're beautiful. Every baby is beautiful. Right? I just saw on the news a few days ago, you saw that baby that was born that was 14 and a half pounds? Unbelievable baby. He's beautiful. How can you not be beautiful? So on a pshat level, we'll talk about what kitov means, but there's clearly echoes of creation here. Vatera, to see that it was goodly, like God saw his creation and saw it was goodly. It was good. And so, on one level, the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu is a continuation of the theme of creation. And it's interesting, the Midrash here really picks up on that, because the Midrash, which many of us are familiar, says, what does it mean, Vatera Kitovu? Nitmale Habayit Ora, which should remind you of the beginning of creation. Yehi Or, Vatar Kitov, and God saw it was good. So, on one level, it's important to recognize that the birth of Moshe is part of, and the early birth and the youth of Moshe, is part of the general theme of the beginning of the book of Exodus to connect us, to reimagine creation, creation of the microcosmos. But I want to go now to the second stage of reading the text in and of itself and comparing it with the Midrashic read. So I'd like to read just the first, chapter 2 divides itself into two units. It's very clear here. The first unit from Pasuk Aleph through Pasuk Yud is Moshe in utero, birth and babyhood. And the key word in this entire section from Pasuk Aleph through Pasuk Yud, Perek Bet, chapter 2, verse 1 to 2, 10, the key word, I think it repeats itself seven times, is the word yeled, a child. From verse 11 through the end, through verse 22, is the, I wouldn't say adolescence, but the young adulthood of Moshe. And the key word there is the word ish. It's a very nice transition. We go from the word yeled seven times to the word ish seven times. Two halves. We're going to focus today on the first half, on the Yeled story, on Moses, the in utero, Moses, the baby, and Moses, the little boy, up until verse 11. Let's read very straightforward. Put all of our preconceptions, misconceptions, everything else. Let's read it with new eyes. Let's just read it without the, let's have an unmediated confrontation with the text. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi vayikach et bat Levi. And a man from the house of Levi took a woman from the house of Levi. What are their names? We don't know. Are they rich? We don't know. Are they poor? We don't. Are they of Yichus? We don't know. We don't know anything about them. That's what the text throws us in to a story. In fact, if you woke me up 3 o'clock in the morning, I don't know anything about this family, where they live. How are they important? Are they not important in the society? In fact, if I read this, it's as if they're getting married for the first time. One young couple. They don't have any kids before. It sounds like they got married. They have kids. Does Moses have any sisters, brothers? I don't know. It seems irrelevant to the focus of the story at this point. Now we, because we are the omniscient readers, and we've read all of Chumash, and we go to Kriyas HaTorah, and we listen, hopefully. So we know that Moshe has a sister, and he has a brother. But the reader is not presented with that information right away. In fact, we only know who these parents are. We find out about that in chapter 6 of the book of Shemot, in Parshat Va'era. In Parshat Va'era, the Chumash wakes up and tells us the genealogy of Moshe. In the beginning of Parshat Va'era. But here we don't know. We don't know Amram. We don't know Yocheved. Everybody else who's born, we know their names. And this one begat that one. It could have been a very nice genealogy, a la Bereshit, but the Torah does not present it that way. Anonymous, in fact, you know, it's like that, I don't know, they still read it, but when I was in college, there's a book, right? Who wrote the book? Every Man. Or whatchamacallit? It was a play? It was a play or a book? Every Man in the Middle Ages. I'm sorry? A morality play, right? Every Man. Vatar ha'isha vateled bein. And she conceives, and she had a child. Anything strange about that? Sounds exactly like every other woman from the beginning of time till the end of time. Vatar, they conceived, they had a child. Doesn't say anything different than any other conception that we find in the Bible. Vatere oto kitovu. She saw that he was good. Now, what does it mean on a pshat level, he was good? I said it before, every baby is good. In biblical Hebrew, I think tov in this context means he wasn't deformed. He was healthy. He was viable. Lots of children are born, and they're not healthy, and they're not viable. What's the point of killing yourself to try to protect the baby who's going to die in a month anyway? What's the point of endangering yourself and your neighbors to try to put a child in a teva if the child has no chance of viability? Vatero tokitovu. She saw he was good. He was healthy, and he had a chance to live. So let's give this baby a chance to live. So she hid him. Why couldn't she hide him anymore? Doesn't say, but probably because you can't go around hiding. Remember, they don't live in McMansions like today. They don't have all these, you know, they don't have 400 bedrooms and 300, you know. They lived, and so the Egyptians would see the baby, you have to bring food. Who knows? It's very straightforward. And so she puts him in the Tevat Gomer. Al-Svatayor. And all of a sudden we're introduced, and she stands from afar to see what would happen. Also, very straightforward, nothing challenging about any of this. And we have the fortuitous hashkacha, the divine providence, that Bat Paro goes down, and she sees the teva, and she sends one of her servants to get it, and she looks. She sees a child crying. She has mercy. How does she know he's a Jewish baby? Simple, direct, without any fancy, no preconceptions. Why would she know he's a Jewish baby? Because the talis? Where does it say the talis? Where does it say that in the text? I don't see. You watch the movie. In the movie. What? Where does it say that in the text? What babies are floating around? It's like, God forbid, in the Shoah, you find a child hidden somewhere. You know, they're obviously running away from the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. She saw, what's babies being thrown in the Nile? It's obviously a Jewish child. You don't have to be a big brain surgeon to figure that out. What? What are you talking about? We know from the previous chapter that they were throwing the children to be extinct. And we see that someone's cast the child in a... It certainly makes much more sense to figure out. Well, maybe it's a... She figures out it's a Jewish child.
How do we know that the Egyptian wouldn't do this?
Why would the Egyptians do this?
I don't know. I mean, but it doesn't say here.
It doesn't say... Let's think about the most logical reading. The most logical reading is if you find an abandoned child in the middle of the river, Mistama, it's because this child was in danger. Mistama.
Or a young mother abandoned the child.
Right.
Or the child is dressed in a blanket that has a pattern.
Could be. It could be. Yeah. Correct. But the text is very silent on the reason.
But you could, it's great.
Right. Now the text continues. Vatomer Achol told Bat Paro, Ha'eleich v'karati lach, and she says, yes. And she goes. Vatelech ha'alma v'tikrat eim ha'yelid. She goes, calls the mommy. Vatomer la Bat Paro, Ha'elichi et ha'yelid hazeh, ve'nikilu, v'ani eten et schareich, v'tikach ha'isha yelid v'tinikim. Va'yigdal ha'yelid. Where does the child grow up? I want to shock some people. According to the text, where does the child grow up? With the mother, or in the court of Pharaoh. Then Vativiyehu lebat Paro. How old was the child when she brings him? Doesn't say. Maybe he was there till he was 5, 6. He grew up. Who knows? It's very ambiguous. Notice it doesn't say that Moshe grew up in the house of Pharaoh explicitly as a little baby with the coal and all that. It doesn't say any of that in the text. In fact, really? How come it says Vatinikehu? Then it says Vayigdal Hayeled. It's interesting. It doesn't say Vatinikehu, Vatavioto El Paro. It says Vayigdal Hayeled, Vativiehu Lebat Paro. I'm not sure. My point is, I'm not sure. And I don't even know what Vayhi La Levain means in biblical Hebrew. Benno Jacob, Zichrono Livracha, the great German Bible exegete, makes a very big deal about pointing out that in biblical, you know, we have examples in the Bible of people adopting, right? Which is the most famous example of adoption in the Bible? Esther. And what's the language that the Bible uses there when it wants to say, and Mordechai took her, but, no, but what does it say? No, but before that, what is it? Vayhi o omein et hadasahi Esther. It's interesting. So Benno Jacob says, you know, the Bible has good biblical Hebrew words to talk about adoption. It's unclear here. Is it a real adoption? Did he really grow up in the house of Pharaoh? I know I'm shocking some preconceptions. I don't know. And at what age did he come to the house of Pharaoh? Vatikra shmo Moshe. Maybe she was the godmother. Vatomer kimin amayim mishitihu. My point is, it doesn't say explicitly any of that. It doesn't in the text. In fact, if I wanted to step back on a meta theme and ask myself, what's the birth of Moshe as described in the pshat of the text, the plain sense of the text? Remember, the word pshat doesn't mean literal. The word pshat means the plain sense of the text. I always like to tell the story that I heard from my teacher, Nechama Leibovitz, right? Nechama is very fond of, she used to get angry when people would say pshat means literal, because that's not true. The best example is, in the Bible it says, Umaltem et Orlat Levavchem, in Dvarim Perek Lamed. It does not mean that every Jew has to undergo a heart bypass operation. You know, it means that, right, it's a metaphor. And that's in biblical Hebrew. Sometimes, you know, I like to give the example of the Bugs Bunny cartoon, where he's talking to his kids, and he says, and it was raining cats and dogs. And in the cartoon, cats and dogs actually come down. Now, obviously, the pshat there is that it was raining hard. The literal, and in rabbinic Hebrew, when you want to say something is literal, they usually use the word mashma, as it sounds. That's why Rashi says, ufshuto kemashma'o, meaning that there's pa'amim shepshuto shelo kemashma'o. There are many times in pshutos. In modern Hebrew, you would say miluli, from the word milah. It's literal as it sounds. Okay, back to home base. So the pshat, in fact, if we read the pshat of the birth of Moshe, it's very interesting. Moses is born in a normal family. We don't know anything about Yocheved and Amram. We don't even know their names. It could be anybody. It could be you and me. Two guys, a shoemaker and a homemaker. Who knows what? These are simple Jews, Yidden, who had a kid. Bat Levi. Doesn't say that Amram was smart. Doesn't say he was a Rosh Hashiva. Doesn't say he was rich. Doesn't say any of those things in the text. And it doesn't say anything. And she had a kid. It was a normal kid who was born, who's put in a... And God saves the kid. We don't know any... Notice also, the English term is heralding. Notice that we're just thrown into the story. Nowhere does it say that there's an announcement of the birth of this child, as opposed to in the story of Shimshon, for example, in the Bible. Shimshon, the great hero, an angel comes, and this is a whole build-up. Shimshon doesn't just show up. There's a whole build-up. Here there's no build-up. A man fancied a woman. They got married. They had a kid. That's what happens. And that's it. And he grows up, maybe in his parents' home, maybe in the Pharaoh's home, but nothing special. In fact, later on, we're going to be told that this kid has an impediment. He has a speech impediment. A stutterer or something else. It's unclear what he is. But he's certainly not the perfect specimen who ever came out. That's the text. And not only that, but the second half of the text, which we're not going to deal with. What are we told about Moshe? We're not told anything except about his ethical qualities. He saw the taskmaster hitting the Jewish slave. He steps in. He saw two Jews fighting. He steps in. He saw two non-Jews oppressing, right? The shepherd boys basically manhandling the shepherd women, the daughters of Yitro, and he steps in. The only thing we're told about Moshe Rabbeinu in the biblical text is his quality of ethics and morality, that he can't abide injustice. And then in Perek Gimel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to him and reveals himself at the Sneh and says, I want you to take out the Jewish people. That's the narrative that's presented in the text. A man got married to a woman. They had a nice wedding. They had a kid. Everything is plain Jane. And then the child is set off. He's saved. And that's it. And because of his ethical qualities, he seems to be the best candidate to be the Moshiach, to be the savior of the Jewish people. That's the biblical text. We don't know anything about what Moshe looks like. We don't know, is he tall? Is he short? Is he fat? Is he skinny? Is he smart? Is he dumb? We don't know anything about it. We don't know anything about, did God predict? No, there's no predictions. There's nothing here in the text. Very straightforward. Now I'd like to read with you the Midrashim and the Hellenistic. We'll get to the New Testament. Can I say the word New Testament on tape, Jay? Is it okay? I'm not going to get you in trouble? Okay. Yes, yes. I'm going to try. That's what they pay me the small bucks for. Yes. Yeah. There's no statistics, but we certainly have few who are. So let's take a look at the Midrashim. This is from Shmot Rabbah. Shmot Rabbah, this is the academic edition by my teacher, Professor Avigdor Shinan, which I kind of pasted together for you. So in Shmot Rabbah, we have a very different reading. Shmot Rabbah it's not the latest Medrash that was ever compiled. It's not the earliest Medrash that was ever compiled. Probably sometime, late in the Amoraic period, it was compiled finally, as we have it today. or maybe later, a little bit later. But it certainly has material that goes back much before that. Like any Sefer, lots of Svarim were edited finally at a certain time, but they have material that's very ancient. I'm not getting into the whole quest. Well, maybe I should make that comment. I should really start. Before we go into the Midrashim themselves, I come from the mainstream Jewish tradition, which is that when it comes to Midrash Agadah, meaning this is the tradition of the Gaonim, and of Rav Haigon, Rav Sadia Gaon, the tradition of, and most of the Rishonim, and many of the Achronim, which is that when it comes to Midrashei Agadah, they do not have the same binding, authoritative nature as Midrashei Halacha. Meaning, while the rabbis asserted for themselves the authority, and they claimed that many of the laws that they were transmitting go back to Sinai, Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, we never find the term Agadah L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. In fact, the Gaonim make it very explicit. They use the term Umdina Ninhu. When there's a machloket, when there's a debate in the Talmud about whether Tzlafchad, who was Mr. Tzlafchad? Was he the Mekoshei Sheitzim? Or was he somebody else? So Rav Haigon says, Umdina Ninhu. That's an estimation. That's a guess. If you want to accept it, accept it. If you don't want to accept it, don't accept it. Meaning, there is no binding authoritative nature to Midrashei Agadah, to narrative portions of Agadah in the Talmud. You want to accept it? Accept it. You don't want to accept it. That's what allows for the whole range of freedom of interpretation in the whole exegetical world, in the history of Parshanut. How can Ibn Ezra say, yeah, the rabbis, some rabbis claim Yitzchak was 37 years old at the Akedah, but at the plain sense of the text, they say he was 13, 14, 15. So, I don't have to accept it. And the same thing with many other Midrashei Agadah. That's where the world that I'm coming from. It's not necessarily the world that certainly the Haredi world often speaks to, but that's the majority mainstream position within the Jewish tradition. That's the tradition of the Gaonim. That's the tradition of most of the Rishonim, which allows for the freedom of interpretation. And even people like the Or HaChaim, who's generally a much more traditional commentator, in his introduction says things like that. It was a classic approach that was kind of given. It was a given that allowed for a tremendous amount of freedom of interpretation till today. I think that's one of the major divides till today between modern Orthodox Parshanut HaMikra, modern Orthodox biblical exegesis, and Haredi exegesis. Besides, without getting into the very, difficult area of Midrashei Halacha, which I'm keeping it simple, just Midrashei Agadah now, it's clear that the rabbinic tradition saw a lot of freedom of interpretation. Coming back to home base. So we have the Midrashim. Let's start with the Midrashim. Look on the left side. Look back in Perek Aleph. I'm not Perek Aleph, but this one is going to relate to Perek Aleph. Vatityatzev. So Miriam stood from afar to see. Now, the text from afar means she didn't want to be discovered. So she's looking through the brush. But the Midrash, in a wonderful play, also plays on Rachok, but I don't want to get to that yet. Lama amda Miriam merachok. Why did she stand from the side? On the left-hand side on the top. Amar Rav Amram b'shem Rav. It's a great name, Rav Amram. It's very cute. Rav Amram said in the name of Rav, Lefi shaita Miriam mitnaba'at. Miriam, for the last few months, had been giving nevuah. Va'omeret, atida imi sheteled ben shemoshiach Yisrael. The heralding of the hero. My mommy is going to have a Moshiach. V'kevan shenolad nitmale kol habayit ora. This child can't be a regular child. This child has to come with a, instruction manual. He's coming and when he's born, he's telling you he's somebody special. Amad avia v'nashkal rosha amar la biti nitkaimav nevuatech. V'haynu diktiv v'tikach Miriam hanevia achot Aaron et tof biyada. V'chi arot achot Aaron v'lo achot Moshe. El shamra kshu Aaron v'adayin l'nolad Moshe. She was Aaron, she was Miriam hanevia when there was only Aaron around. She was already a nevia. Continues the Midrash. V'kevan she'tilu li'or amda ima v'tafchal rosh ha'ma heichan hi nevuatech. When he was thrown into the sea, into the river, she said, oh, what's going to happen? What's happening with your prophecy?
היינו דקטיב, ותתייצב אחותו מרחוק, לדעי המעשה לו, לדעת מה יהיה בסוף נבואתו. מרחוק means, not in terms of space, but in time. She wanted to see what would happen in the future. So you have a very powerful midrash of the heralding of the child. And in fact, the midrash creates a whole prehistory that Amram and Yocheved got divorced or stopped sleeping together. And it was only through the instigation of the divine prophecy to Miriam that got them back together. The hero almost wasn't born. He almost was an accident that was, he almost didn't happen. If not for Miriam bringing them together. Not only that, did I Xerox this as well? A second Midrash, I don't know if I Xeroxed it, but the second Midrash goes even further and says not only did Miriam get this Nevuah, but Amram directly got this Nevuah. There are other Midrashim. And the Midrash says, Amram Gedol Hador Haya. Very famous Midrash. It's here also, I'm sorry? Where? Oh, top right. Thank you very much. Where is it? Thank you. Vayelch ish mit Levi vaykach lehechan halach amara shalach batzat pito. He went batzat pito. Now, in biblical Hebrew, you don't have to, when it says vayelech, that's the way it talks. It's like, you know, there's certain words in biblical Hebrew. He went and took her. You don't have to go anywhere. Just like vayikach korach, that's part of biblical language. You don't have to take anything. That's part, he took himself, in effect. But the Midrash says, Tani, Amram gedol hador haya. Moshe can't be born in a little shtetl from a shoemaker and from a tailor. Moshe Rabbeinu was the son of the gedol hador. In another Midrash, it's Rosh Sanhedrin haya. There was no Sanhedrin then, but the anachronistic playing back and projecting that Amram, he's not just Stamazoi, a yid, he's a yichustika. He's a Rebbe She'enikel, to use our terminology, as yichus. Very powerful. So the child is heralded. The child has yichus. Go further. The Midrash goes even further. Rashi cites it and says, why did Pharaoh decide to throw the Jewish baby boys into the sea? Why didn't he just kill them b'cherev, right? So what does the Midrash say? Because his itstagninim shalo, his astrologers, right? Told him, exactly. His astrologers told him that they had seen in the Kochavim, in the astrology, that the Moshiach, that the Savior was born to the Jewish people, and he would be destroyed by water. And they misunderstood. They didn't know that it was going to be the water story of Mei Merivah, of the Moshe sin. And they understood, throw them in the water. Now in this version of the Midrash, so not only is the Papa Bear told that there's going to be a miracle child, not only is the daughter, but the enemy is heralded. The Moshiach cannot just show up on the screen. It's like Shimshon. Shimshon had a heralding, so it must be Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe velokam ishki. So Moshe as a baby, not just Moshe as the finished product, but the hero must have a heralding. The hero must have yichus. The hero must have all these qualities. Continues the Midrash. Midrash says, Vayikach bat Levi. Let's go back to the right hand side. Ve'echzir lo nemar vayikach. Amar Rav Baravina. Shasabo ma'aseli kuchin. Hoshiva ba'aparyon u'miryam ba'aron miraktim lefanav u'malachei asharit umrim eva banim smech aluya. This is not Stamazoya wedding. This is a wedding where the angels come. Okay? That's pretty good. Not just, you didn't just fly in the Rosh Hashiva. You fly in, the angels are at this wedding. Okay? Bat Levi. So we have echoes of Sarah. Efshar bat kuf lamid shana v'kari le bat. She was 130. Now in biblical Hebrew, that's what you say. You're 130 years old. Bat. You're Ben. Right? That's just. But the Midrash, in its hyper omni significance of every word, and playing off, this is a wonderful example of a theme throughout the entire Midrashic narrative. Shenoldula simanei na'arut. She was already past menopause, but there was a miracle. that she, once again, it doesn't say that in the text here. It doesn't say how old she was. We don't know how old she was. The Midrash is working off of another Midrash, which says that she was 100, but... Vatar ha'isha vatelet bay. The Midrash continues. Elamakish le'data lehorata. Mahorata shelo bitzar. Just as conception happened without any pain. Af le'data shelo bitzar. Mikan le'nashim tzidkaniot shelo hayu bepitka shel chava. So the birth was painless. So it was a miraculous birth. There was no pain during pregnancy. There was no pain during... It was all... And not only that, so Amram is a gedol hador, and Yocheved is an isha tzidkanit, a tzadekes. The Medrash continues. Towards the bottom of the page, there you have the shiyucho shvim ha'itztagnin shekvar hushlach b'mayim. And then the child is born. We already mentioned the Midrash of Nitmale Habayit Orah. It was full of light. We already mentioned, how does she know that this child... How does she know that this child is Jewish? Look at the bottom left-hand side. Vatiftach vatireu et hayeled. Vatireha vatireh lo nemar. Vatirehu. Amar Rav Yosef v'chanina shirata imo shechina. She saw the divine presence with Moses. He was a child, but he had the voice of a teenager, etc., etc. And then we have again the angel showing up. This child was so precocious he didn't want to cry. Gabriel has to come and make this child cry. And of course, I didn't put on this sheet because everybody's so familiar with it, that the Midrash about the gold and the coal. This child is so brilliant, is that this child is, they put in front of him the coal, right? Because they want to test, because the Itztagninim say, this child is going to bother you, Pharaoh, because the child is taking off the crown of Pharaoh, the famous Midrash. And they say, let's test to see if he's really a child or he's the savior child. And they put coal and gold. And Moses is so precocious and so smart, he wants the gold. Why do I want the coal? And the angel has to come and say, no, take the coal, and hits him. And that's how he gets kvad peh. So there's a number of themes in this Midrash. The Midrash, of course, is saying, look how smart he was, and only they had to hide how smart he was. Number two, the kvad peh is a result of a divine intervention. It's not somehow something inherently wrong with Moses. So you have a whole different picture when you read the birth of Moshe and the babyhood of Moshe, when you read it in the Midrash versus when you read it in the text. And furthermore, I didn't Xerox this, but the Midrashim go even further. As Moses grows up, they talk about how smart Moses is and how beautiful he is. The Midrash says, Sa'ada lav b'not shur, that everyone who passed by him stopped and looked at Moshe Rabbeinu. They used to look at him. He was so beautiful. Which reminds you of who in the Bible? Yosef. Meaning, there are elements. Every element that we have, or almost many of the elements that we have here, seem to be a construction from many of the other biblical heroes. The heralding of the hero, Shimshon. The idea of beauty, Yosef. Etc., etc., etc. Now what's interesting is, 500 years before Shmot Rabbah is edited, and even before that, these echoes, and this is what's called in fancy academic literature of the history of ideas in Midrash, the Tradition Geschichte, the history, Geschichte is right, the history of traditions. One of the things that they love to do is try to find out, where's the first mention of an idea in literature? Where do you see it for the first time? And what's interesting is, many of these ideas, they first have their echoes in the earliest Jewish Hellenistic writings. Jewish Hellenistic writings. In fact, before I turn the page, before we get to Philo and Josephus, I didn't get a chance to Xerox one that's even more radical, And that's, which I don't have, I didn't get a chance to Xerox it because I couldn't find it in my notes. But there's a book, before you read just Philo and Josephus, I want to read to you a fragment from a book called Artapanos. Artapanos was a Jewish Hellenist, real hardcore Hellenist. Real, you know, probably one of those guys that Matityahu would have, you know, killed. And Yehuda would have, you know, just chopped him off, you know, at the head. And but that was a lot of Jews, probably. And Artapanos writes about, in his book on Moses, he writes as follows. He says, and since she was barren, meaning the daughter of the Pharaoh in his history, she adopted the child of one of the Jews and named it Moses. And as a grown man, he was called Moises by the Greeks. This Moises was the teacher of Orpheus. As a grown man, he bestowed many useful benefits on mankind, for he invented boats and devices for stone construction, and the Egyptian arms, and the implements for drawing water and for warfare and philosophy. Further, he divided the state into 36 nomes and appointed for each of the nomes the gods to be worshipped, and for the priests and sacred letters. He did all these things, etc., etc., etc. On account of all these things, Moses was loved by the masses and was deemed worthy of godlike honor by the priests and called Hermes on account of the interpretation. This is Artapanos, about 180 BCE, a hardcore Jewish Hellenist. What do you see? You see, he's living, if I'm not mistaken, in Egypt, in Alexandria, places like that. And I have to check again. Don't hold me to it. Don't kill me. But I think that's where he lived. Artapanos is one of the earliest writings that we have of Jewish Hellenistic ideas. Philo is, you know, around a little bit, about what, 50 BC, Philo? Around then, around the turn of the zero. So, right. So what you see is floating around, and it makes perfect sense. Moshe Rabbeinu is an unbelievable. He's our hero par excellence. Moshe Rabbeinu. He's Gevaltik. He's our teacher. But if you read the Pshat, he doesn't have the qualities of the Greek hero. He's not beautiful. We don't know, was he tall, was he short, was he handsome? We don't know that. He certainly has an impediment, he has a speech, that's what the text says. We don't know whether he was smart or not. We know he has nevuah, but the text never says, chacham mikol adam. It says that by Yosef, ein chacham v'navon kamocha. It says that Yosef was beautiful. It says that Shimshon, all the qualities that eventually become identified with the Greek hero, or many elements of Hellenistic thought, which have a tremendous impact on Judaism, just like every culture that Judaism ever interacted with, whether it was Aristotelianism, Neoplatonism, and all, you know, and all the other isms that have shaped who we are today. You know, the Yiddishkeit that we, you know, the Rambam and everything, and Chassidus and Kabbalah. So Hellenism also had it. Obviously, there were limits. And you see, Artapanos is not mainstream Jewish thing. You see, this is called refining. This is called, but I believe that the source of many of these ideas have their roots in Jewish Hellenistic thought. The attempt to portray Moses. Who's the greatest hero in history? Is it Hercules? Is it this? Is it that? Or is it Moshe Rabbeinu? This was a big issue. Just like Lahavdil, or maybe not Lahavdil, in the Middle Ages, the Jews and the Muslims had a big fight. Which is the greatest literature? What is the book of the greatest literature? Is it the Quran, because it has the best meter and the best poetry? Or is it, no, the Bible, and I can show you that it has Moshe ibn Ezra and all these. What? You live in a culture which glorifies X, Y, Z. It seeps in. And this is probably the origin of many. Now, this is very extreme, Artapanos. Look at less extreme versions. Look at Philo, which I Xeroxed for you here, in his book on the life of Moses. What you hear here are echoes of Jewish ideas that were very prevalent. If you want to see many Midrashic ideas, before they become formalized in Midrashic language and in effect purified through the prism of Rabbinic Judaism. You see them in books like Philo and Josephus and Artapanos and Apocrypha. You see ideas and their origin before they've been purified of their Hellenistic, paganistic, etc. And so Philo will also say, look at this. Look at fourth line from the top. Therefore, the child being now thought worthy of royal education and royal attendance. So Moshe can't grow up in a little neighborhood in Borough Park, whatever. He's got to have been brought up. If he's going to be the king, he was brought up. He got the best teachers. He went to the best private school. He was not a mere child, long delighted with toys and objects of laughter and amusement. No. Moshe, he never had a stuffed animal. No. Even those who had undertaken the care of him, allowed him holidays and times for relaxation, never behaved in any stern. But he himself exhibited a modest and dignified deportment in all his words and gestures, attending diligently to every lesson of every kind which could tend to the improvement of his mind. And immediately he had all kinds of masters, one after another, some coming from their own accord from the neighboring countries and the different districts, and some being even procured from Greece by the temptation of large presents. But in a short time he surpassed all their knowledge. When I read this the first time, it's mamish like the story of the Gdolim, right? They had a Melamed till they were five, but it wasn't. They surpassed all their Melamdim. They had to go to Bialystok to learn with this Rebbe, and then they went to the yeshiva. It's the same degem of, if you're dealing with a great character, so this is part of the hagiography around him. But in a short time, he surpassed all the knowledge, etc., etc. And just as vigorous and healthy bodies, next paragraph, which are active and quick in motion, release their trainers from much care, giving them little or no trouble, etc., etc., so in the same manner, the well-disposed soul going forward to meet the lessons by itself rather than by teachers, and taking hold of some beginning. Accordingly, he speedily learnt arithmetic and geometry and the whole science of rhythm and harmony and meter and the whole of music by means. He's the expert in everything. He's the Renaissance man. He's the ideal hero. And not only that, and all the other branches of the encyclical education he learned from the Greeks and the philosophers from the adjacent countries taught him Assyrian literature and the knowledge of the heavenly bodies. And he derived mathematics, mamish everything. And then, if you look on the bottom of the right-hand side, very naturally, therefore, those who associated with him and everyone who was acquainted with marveled at him, being astonished as at a novel spectacle, and inquiring what kind of mind is it that had abode in his body, and that was set up in it like an image in a shrine, whether it was a human mind or a divine intellect, or something combined of the two, because he had nothing in him resembling the many, but had gone beyond them, etc., etc. Take a look at Josephus, getting a little closer to Josephus. Talks about how she picked him up from the water. Look at where 229. And he was by the confession of all according to God's prediction, as well for his greatness of mind as for his contempt of difficulties, the best of all Hebrews. Moshe is the best. For Abraham was his ancestor of the seventh generation. This is the seventh. He's the Shvi. It's like the seventh Rebbe. He's the Mashiach. For Moses was the son of Amram, who was the son of etc. Now Moses' understanding became superior to his age, nay, far beyond that standard. And when he was taught, he discovered greater quickness of apprehension that was usual at his age. And his actions at the time promised greater. God did also give him that tallness. Moshe was tall. When he was but 3 years old, as was wonderful. And as for his beauty, there was nobody so unpolite as when they saw Moses, they were not greatly surprised at the beauty of his countenance. Remember, who's Josephus writing to? He's writing for his, he's defending, as he sees, a Judaism and the honor of Judaism to a Hellenistic audience and to his Greek and to his Roman masters. And he's saying, you think Hermes and Hercules? No, I'm telling you, who was the real hero of all time? Who was the greatest of the great? It was Moshe Rabbeinu. He was more beautiful. And there was nobody, they were not greatly surprised. Nay, it happened frequently that those who met him as he was carried along the road were obligated to turn again upon seeing the child. Banot Sa'ada Aleishur. About Yosef. All the women would look at him. And the Medrash says it. I didn't Xerox it, but this Medrash Rabbah says that whenever they passed Moshe, they would stop and look at him. He was so beautiful. Etc., etc. And so what you have here is two versions of who is the ideal hero. And it's interesting because in Tanakh also, you have echoes of those two phenomenon. You have two voices within the tradition. Is the great hero the person who doesn't come from anything special, just a regular person, but by dint of his character, his moral character, the fact that he steps in when he sees injustice, that's what makes him ra'ui l'gdula. That's what makes him worthy to become the hero, to become the savior of the Jewish people. Or no, is it that the hero has to be predetermined by God and he must have those qualities that we often associate with hero, with hero-ness? And it's the tension throughout societies, even in American and Canadian societies today, where they talk about, you know, who can be the president? You know, Joe Biden put his foot in his mouth. Exactly. About is image, is yichus, is money, or is it something else? What is it? And Chazal too often have contrasting, you know, voices. Sometimes Chazal make a very big deal about, you know, Torah v'gdula b'makom echad, ashirus b'makom echad. Is that the ideal? Or is it, you know, b'nei banav shalaniim, they're the ones who are going to, the children and grand, they're the ones who are going to eventually become the leadership. And in Chassidus also, who's the great leader? Is it the one who has yichus, the Rebbe She'enikel, or the one who worked hard on his own? It's a very big tension throughout Jewish life and Jewish history. Who's the ideal leader? Who's the model? And maybe we can have different models. And the impact of Jewish Hellenistic thinking, which eventually, as I said, was slowly filtered from its dross. Remember, you can't have Moshe Rabbeinu going around, you know, being the author of Avodah Zarah. So that kind of radical Hellenistic stuff, paganistic stuff, gets filtered out from the tradition. But the idea that he was beautiful and handsome, is that a Jewish value? Whatever that means, what's a Jewish value? But is that an original, certainly not in the text about Moshe, it's about Yosef, maybe about Avshalom, who doesn't have such a great ending. Maybe David, Tov Roi, whatever that means. Shaul, Gvoa Milamala. There are people who are presented as being a beautiful human. I'm sorry? The women are very often beautiful. Yifat Tor, Yifat Mar'eh. And right, but you know, we don't know anything about Avraham's beauty. We don't know anything about, you know, but it's interesting. Here's the tension. And as I said, somebody mentioned it. The same thing. What do you think our friends, the Hebrew Christians, who were trying to impact on Jews, when they write the New Testament, the book of Matthew, when it tries to project Jesus, Yeshu HaNotzri, as the Jewish Messiah in first century Eretz Yisrael, they obviously are going to try to play off the themes that are going to resonate with Jews. And so if you read the book, thank you, if you read the book of Matthew, the early chapters, there's a conscious attempt to make Jesus, baby Jesus, okay, like baby Moshe. It was so funny once, you know, my kid came home last year from nursery school and he has, you know, they bring a little Moshe and a little Teva. You know, and like, you know, we come home and I think, and my son Ephraim says, Abba, do you know what this is? And I want to say it's baby Jesus, but, you know, but it's baby Moshe. Of course, it's baby Moshe. Mamash listens. But it's exactly, what did they do in the book of Matthew? They take the theme of the astrology, right? There was the stars that tell the wise men that there's a heralding of a savior that's going to come to Israel. And Herod is projected as Pharaoh. He commands all the Jewish boy babies to be killed. And then Jesus and his family go down to Egypt. And then they come back. It's all about patterning Jesus to be the second Moshe. And to be, because he's going to overturn the laws of Moses. And he's the second Eliyahu. All these things are about. And so therefore you're going to use the Midrashim and Midrashic themes that resonate with Jews. And so this is something very powerful that, again, is interesting. This is a wonderful example of a sustained midrashic read of an entire parak, not just a comment here, a comment there. And it really is very fascinating about how we read these stories. Now, it doesn't take, one who doesn't ever read Midrashim like this in that light is going to be, oh, what does it mean? But that's the reality. That's the reality of many of the Midrashim here that have their origins in Jewish Hellenistic thinking. But they become filtered and they become part of our tradition and we have to deal with them. Just like, and the same thing goes on throughout history. I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the other side, Moshe Rabbeinu, the portrait of Moses. Professor Schneer Lyman has written about this. You know, there's a famous story that starts to pop up in the Middle Ages about how Moshe was the most ugly person on earth. And only through the dint of his force, and you have the Shlomo Carlebach story. If you're ugly, if you think I'm ugly, it's because you're ugly. I mean, all these tensions within the tradition about it. Okay, so we have a couple of minutes for questions. If anybody wanted to ask something, please feel free. Oh, we have a microphone.
You say that these are the Midrashim, but how do we incorporate the Midrashim with the actual Pshat? I mean, why
do you have to?
Well, if we just look at Pshat, we get only part of the story.
Right.
But obviously, you've made us understand that the Midrashim adds so much.
So I think that it tells us that there are different voices that emerge from our canonical texts. And for me, Tanakh always carries the greatest weight, but that emerge from our canonical text about the tension of who do we hold up as the hero? Who do we hold up as the leader? Maybe there's different models in different times and different situations. I mean, look, let me translate it into real. Who should be the leader of the Jewish community today in Canada? Is it the guy who has the most money? Is it the guy who's connected to the biggest family, the Bronfman, whatever? Or is it somebody who worked hard and spent a lot of hours in the office, stuffing envelopes? Or is it the guy who's the most ethical? I think these are very important, challenging, interesting questions. And the different voices within the tradition that make us think about, maybe there are times when Dafka, maybe it's ideal to have all those qualities together. I'm finishing. Yeah. I can't give you a button answer that says, oh. And sometimes maybe that's the tension. Yes, Rabbi Berman. Dr. Berman.
I'll speak to you.
Okay. Thank you so much for your hakshavah.